This interview is part of an oral history project for the Association for the Rhetoric of Science and Technology. Learn more at arstonline.org.
My name is Judy Siegel, and I teach in the English department at the University of British Columbia, where I am professor.
And can you talk to us a bit about some of your past and current research?
Yes. If I can tell a longish period of story, while not telling a very long story, I wrote a pretty early in the discipline medical rhetoric dissertation, and that was in 1988. And what I did was look at rhetorical strategies in medical journal articles on functional headache. And there wasn't a lot of literature in rhetoric of medicine available. So I used rhetoric of science literature and rhetorical criticism and so on. That was a very textual sort of analysis. And when I got to the end of it, I had a revelation. I had a revelation at the end of writing my dissertation, which was that all of this analysis that I did meant something about the culture of medicine and about not just textual rhetoric, but a larger cultural, discursive, professional rhetoric. And so I began to work on, I guess, bigger and slightly more amorphous topics. And they included writing about health policy and how the terms of debate constrain what gets argued at all in health policy. Patient compliance, adherence, concordance, that sort of thing, contested illnesses. Eventually, some of that became a book that I published in 2005 called Health and the Rhetoric of Medicine. And my work since then, because that's been now 7 years, has been to reach out a bit. I've published more in medical journals, and I have gotten pretty far into a book that's tentatively called Public Discourse, Personal Experience. And then the subtitle is not exactly set yet, but it's on the rhetoric of health and illness in the beginning of the 21st century. So bigger topics, I guess, you know, starting from my dissertation, which was so text-based and so Aristotelian.
Can you tell us a little bit about the argument of that book? I'm intrigued a little bit about personal experience.
Right. Well, it's not my personal experience, so I have to get that out right away. But it's on the way public values get taken up in personal bodies, in private bodies. So how public discourse is a kind of pedagogy of illness, a way of answering the question, how shall I be ill? And so I talk about various sorts of topics. There are several chapters. A couple of them are on pharmaceutical advertising. One of them is on pharmaceutical advertising contemporary as it relates to patent or proprietary medicine advertising in the 19th century. The idea being that we work with narratives in which pharmaceuticals play a very big part and have for a very long time. And we learn something about illness from pharmaceutical ads. I have a chapter on breast cancer discourse, about which I've written a fair bit already in articles here and there. And the argument of that chapter is that we learn from public narratives, which include, you know, narratives that come out of organizations like Susan B. Komen for the Cure, or come out of Estee Lauder, come out of the Pink Campaign, and runs and walks for the cure, how those sorts of stories get taken up by people who have breast cancer, and very much, according to all of my research, affects their experience. There's a chapter on pain, and the way we talk about pain, addiction, dependence, pleasure, all in a very evaluative sort of way that affects the way people with pain conditions, in particular chronic pain conditions, experience their own pain and experience their identities as people who may be suspect as addicts. So it's that kind of thing. That's the public discourse, personal experience part of it. It's how we embody public values.
What piqued your interest in the rhetoric of medicine initially? You said you're one of the first people in the field to write on medical rhetorics
yeah.
in your dissertation.
Well, it started with, I did my MA. My MA was in literature. I got a job immediately teaching at the British Columbia Institute of Technology. I had never encountered such a student before. I taught mechanical engineers, and my job was to teach them business writing and technical writing. And I found that the creepiest part of my job was teaching people how to write sales letters. That was part of every curriculum. And I thought, I'm doing something that I think may be wrong. I think I may be teaching persuasive strategies to people who may use them badly. And I was talking to a friend of mine who taught at the University of British Columbia about this problem and about another problem that I had, which was a problem about objectivity and representation, and that had to do with technical writing, about how, anyway. So you can see how these sorts of questions might form in someone who was teaching at an institute of technology. My friend at UBC told me that there was a field, it was called rhetoric, and people looked at exactly those sorts of questions, and that at the University of British Columbia, Andrea Lunsford and Nan Johnson were the current rhetoricians. And so I made appointments to go and see them. I got a leave of absence, a study leave, actually, from BCIT. And I went to, and I applied to the PhD program. And then I worked with Andrea and Nan. And I said, I have all these questions. And they said, well, you know, there's Plato and Aristotle. And then there's a literature on objectivity. And that was how it began. When I decided that I wanted to do my dissertation on medicine, it was because I had been, because of the objectivity question, reading in the rhetoric of science, and more those questions became for me questions about health and medicine. That just seemed like a really important realm in which to study these sorts of questions about evidence and about facts and about disciplines, and that's how I did it.
So what can you tell me about the history of ARST and your involvement with it?
Well, I figured that out a little bit yesterday because, thank heavens, my CV was on my laptop. So I know that this part I remember. I met Joan Leach, who was already involved in ARST, in 1995, because Joan came to a Canadian History of Rhetoric meeting in Montreal, and I was so excited to meet her because she was working on rhetoric of medicine. She gave a presentation on the Hippocratic Oath, I believe, and I was so excited, and I talked to Joan, and she told me about ARST. So my first ARST was San Diego, 1996. So I can tell you that. And I then have come whenever I can come. I think my first presentation was in 2000. And one of the ARSTs I remember very well is the one that we've been talking about a lot, which is the 2004 one. And I came to, that was the pedagogy one where we started talking about teaching rhetoric of science and keywords. The Keywords Project came out of that. And that was, I think it was in Chicago. And I came with my doctoral student, and she was my first doctoral student in rhetoric of medicine, Colleen Durkacz. And we did a presentation together, and it was enormously fun. And this is the first conference I've been to without a graduate student in all of my years, and that is because Orlando is so very far from where any of us live. So I know that Colleen is very sad to be missing this, but my current graduate students just said, that is too far.
Could you say more about the 2004 conference, the pedagogy conference? Because that's no one's actually mentioned that yet.
Really?
So any details that you have about that?
Well, what we needed to do was come with something that was already written, including syllabi. And I mentioned that this morning in the meeting. Like, we decided that we would share course outlines for how we were teaching rhetoric of science and what we were doing, what we were reading, that sort of thing. And when we arrived at the conference, we were given a binder of all of the stuff that people had sent in. So I still have this binder, and I still refer to it. And it was, you know, one of those conferences where you had to do some work up front, much like the current, like the bicentennial. People sent stuff in, and then it was available for discussion. But the point of the whole thing was pedagogy, and then there emerged this idea, which passed along to Alan Gross, who tried to get a book together, again with one of his graduate students, and we talked about teaching rhetoric of science, and we produced this document, which now is just on the shelves of various people, I guess. So I think it would be a good idea if we, not just the keywords project, but if we took up the pedagogy idea again. I think that would be good.
Can you tell me a little bit about the development of rhetoric of medicine as a field? Because it's been interesting to see how ours has developed. It started as just rhetoric of science.
Right.
Now science and technology, but now everyone is really talking about science, technology, and medicine.
Right. I think, first of all, that if we do change the name, we have to put the M at the beginning and not the end, because the end gives us an unworkable acronym, whereas if we put it at the beginning, it actually gives us a better acronym than we have now, because we would be ARMST, which is preferable, I think, to ARST, but also preferable to ARSTM. So, rhetoric of medicine. Let me see. As I said, when I wrote my dissertation, there was very little that was around. And what I depended on, other than work in rhetoric of science, was Charles Anderson's Richard Seltzer and the Rhetoric of Surgery. Martha Solomon had written an article that I think was in the Western Journal of Speech on the Tuskegee Syphilis Project, a Burkean analysis of journal articles on the Tuskegee Syphilis Project. And Joseph Gusfield's article on drunk driving, which was again a Burkean analysis, but Gusfield was a sociologist. So one of the things that I knew about rhetoric of medicine from the beginning was, one, there wasn't a whole lot of it, and two, some of the most interesting stuff was coming from sociologists. At the time, also, Aaron Sicarel, a sociologist, wrote about case presentations. Renee Ansbach was writing about case presentations. They were doing this as sociologists. So I started to try to put together some kind of bibliography so that I could teach in rhetoric of medicine. And it was an interdisciplinary bibliography. Just gradually, graduate students came up who were interested in the topic. And then I found out over time, because they're younger than I am, about people like Lisa, who were, you know, embracing the field. But I think it's just been growing, and it's only supposed to do that three times. It's been growing in the most amazing way for exactly over the course of my career. So now, Carol Birkencotter, another person who was working in the 1980s, but Carol Carol was doing different sort of work before she got into the rhetoric of medicine, but Carol is another person that I rely on. But then, you know, Amy Korber and Kim Emmons and my own students, Colleen, just have been publishing like crazy, and then Scott Graham appeared, and so they're Blake Scott. So it's just been very exciting to see all these people emerge. And it would be interesting to ask them the question too of where, how they discovered that there was a field there really to mine that I still find endlessly fascinating. I don't think I could live long enough to do all the work that just seems to me exciting to do. And of course, the excitement comes from the work that other people are doing. So that wasn't true 20 years ago. You know, there wasn't a ton of exciting work around, but now there so is. So I guess that it was incremental at the beginning, and now it's kind of exponential, as happens when you have supervisors like Lisa and more and more graduate students entering the field. So I think it is time to change the name.
What do you see as some of the, you know, we've talked a bit about some of the persistent tensions in the rhetoric of science in terms of
right.
whether, you know, epistemic rhetorics versus public rhetorics. That plays out presumably in the rhetoric of medicine as well, but I wonder if you'd like to say something about that. Or is there another tension, is there another kind of intellectual sticking point in the rhetoric of medicine that you'd like to identify and talk about a bit?
I think one of the things that came up in medicine and its publics, the RSA pre-conference in May, was the question of methodology and the dissatisfaction of some, especially younger scholars, with rhetoric itself as a methodology, because it's so amorphous, because you always wind up saying, you know, Kenneth Burke said, use everything, you know, that's there to use. And you can, you know, come at the question of persuasion in so many different ways. And the methodological question is hard to answer from rhetoric alone. So people are using hybrid methodologies. One of my graduate students is doing, you know, critical discourse analysis and rhetoric and did an amazing project. But I think that there's some kind of maybe methodological turn in rhetoric of health and medicine. Scott Graham's work is very social scientific. Scott Graham worked with some of my graduate students last year, and now they talk to me all about coding, you know. So I'm really glad that they have these additional methodologies. And I think that, I mean, and that's why this morning I suggested methodology is being worked in somehow to some future Armst conference, because I think that methodology is of interest to people in the field and how they go about doing the analyses they do, what they count as data. I'm on a doctoral committee now for a student who is looking at the DSM, and her analysis is both genre-based, which is, I mean, we have embraced genre. Carolyn Miller's whole group on Wednesday is more evidence of that rhetorical genre analysis is something that we just do. But what about other sorts of discourse analysis? What else is available to us? So I'm not sure that's a tension or it's just a growth area, okay? But we talked about it in some tense ways in May, and so maybe it's an area that we need to work out as a subdisciplinary tension. Next, I would say that the question of how we bring our work to the public, pretty much sort of thing that Leah raised in her position paper for Wednesday. Leah looked at rhetoric journals and journals like Journal of Medical Humanities, but as Carl Herntel pointed out, you know, there were journals that she didn't look at all that were really, really outside the field. So my own recent publications have been in the journal Headache and Face Pain, Cephalalgia, which is another headache medical journal, and Journal of Sex Research, which I was kind of proud of it, so I mentioned it the other day. But I also do a lot of, I do public lectures, I do lectures with film screenings, so I think that when your field is health and medicine, then maybe, again, not attention, but a direction to think about is how we bring our work to a public audience, because people are really, really interested in these topics. So I think that having ways of reaching people in public lectures, in op-eds, in publications, in various magazines, I think that that's a good thing for us to do. And I think that when we do it, it's a nice thing to explain what a rhetorical analyst is or what a rhetorician is. So it's not just that our analysis is coming out, but also our analysis from a disciplinary perspective that could use greater public recognition.
So you talked earlier about sort of the trajectory of your research. What do you see as your biggest contribution to the rhetoric of medicine?
The introduction to my 2005 book makes a case for how it makes sense to use rhetorical theory to ask questions about health and medical things, and particularly for addressing what I called their intractable problems in health and medicine. So I think that, and especially my encounters with medical schools have reinforced the idea that there are problems like patient compliance, or, you know, what do we do with people with unexplained symptoms, or people who seem to have illness anxiety, or compliance is a big question. Like, what do we do? And they're questions that medicine itself hasn't been able to answer. I think that rhetoric can make a contribution. And so I think one of the arguments that I make in the book is that our projects can be useful even if they're not applied. I think we're very often asked to do work that's applied work. And that came up actually also the other day when we were talking about, you know, being the designated logographers. I don't think that's our job, and I reject that job when it's offered to me. But I think that as a person in rhetoric, I have something to offer the problem solving. I can give another perspective on, you know, why it is that doctors fail to persuade people to, you know, what they might still call follow doctor's orders. And the other thing is, I held a workshop in 2008, and Lisa was there, and Joan Leach, and Deb Dysart-Gale, and Philippa Spool, who's at Laurentian University and is another rhetoric of medicine person and another former graduate student. And then a couple of my own graduate students, Monica Kwiatkowska and Colleen Turkacz. And then a sort of a latecomer to the project was Carol Birkencotter. But the idea, we had a workshop, and the workshop was on knowledge making in medicine. And then we had a book come out that's called Rhetorical Questions of Health and Medicine that Joan and Deb edited. But they came out of these papers from our conference. And my contribution, I think, was to introduce the idea of prior questions, on the idea that if you have something like cosmetic surgery, you'll have surgeons asking how to perform it well, and you'll have health policy people saying, should we cover this sort of thing? But the question, how did we become persuaded that we needed to be cosmetically improved in the first place? That's a question that a rhetorician can ask. So we can ask questions that are prior to the questions that people who are in health and medical professions ask. I felt like that was a good thing to contribute. And I had a conference also in 2006, and it was called What Do the Humanities Contribute to the Health of Persons? It was on the usefulness of humanities, especially, not just social science, because social science, we know, can be very useful. You know, they gave us the idea of social determinants of health and made housing part of thinking about health, that sort of thing. So social scientists, we get that they do important work, but what do people in the humanities actually do? So I had a conference, and I invited the big funders and the big research administrators to come, and then had rhetoricians, historians, philosophers, literary critics present on their work, because the Canadian Institutes of Health Research, which now funds anything that anybody wants to do in health or doesn't fund it, and then people aren't funded. So their mandate was to include social sciences and humanities into health research broadly defined, and they replaced in Canada the MRC, the Medical Research Council. So in 2000, MRC became CIHR, and at that point, I became quite involved with CIHR on the idea that somebody needed to explain to these people what people in the humanities actually did. By 2006, it was clear to me that nobody really did still understand that. So I had a conference. And so part of what I've tried to do is make a case, especially in funding agencies in Canada, for the sorts of contributions that humanities researchers make, and rhetoricians in particular make, to helping to solve intractable problems in health and medicine.
We have asked folks about how the internet sort of plays into all of this, and I know you have articles, Internet Health, and so the rise of the internet, how does it invite or complicate the work that we do in the rhetoric of science and technology?
Such a hard question. I don't think there's any work that any of us does that isn't influenced by the internet and the sheer quantity of stuff that's out there and probably needing some sort of rhetorical attention. So in about 2003, when I was working on the last book, one of the things that I became interested in was illness narratives or pathographies. And one of the places that I looked for pathographies was the extremely disturbing eating disorders websites. And I understood then, and that's almost 10 years ago, that there was this conversation that was happening that was problematic, but that also, so it was just very interesting from a narrative point of view. Like what I was writing about was pathography as genre, and in reading the various stories of the people who were identifying as anorexics or bulimics, their stories followed such an interesting pattern. So I actually became quite obsessed with reading not just their stories, and actually eventually, those are very hard to get into now because those sites are talked about as enabling sites, and so you have to have some kind of commitment in order to be able to have access. So I don't check that one out anymore. But when I started writing about breast cancer narratives, I also started looking at websites, patient websites, and when I started working on pain, I looked at pain websites. And there are more and more Well, I guess that I want to reiterate the point that I made in that article that you referred to, the Internet Health article, that I think that a lot of what gets said has to do with the source. You know, if you're getting reliable information, everything's okay. But I think that the sorts of transformations that take place when we're using information that we get that way confuses us about what counts as data, what counts as information, and what counts as knowledge, and what counts as story, and what story has to do with any of those three things, too. So I think that there is a lot to think about, but the other part of the question about the internet is what the internet enables us to do. So the way I do research has changed completely. I have probably 1,000 paper articles in my office that I don't need anymore because I use the web for accessing everything. I published in my first online journal 2 weeks ago, which was Present Tense, and I guess at the end of all this, I'll publish in my second online journal when the Poor Eye stuff comes out. I think that all of that is a very exciting way for us to have a public profile in the way that Linda was talking about public profile the other day. You put something on in an online journal in an open access space and people find out about you. I have had the experience several years ago. I gave a talk at an international genre conference, and without my knowing it, they put all the papers up. So I'm not thrilled that they did that because the paper didn't seem to be ready for publication in any form. It was still a conference paper. However, I had such a ton of response to that conference paper. And people wrote to me, and, you know, so I think that as researchers and writers, we're very fortunate to have these new venues. I think for supplying text and text-like objects and images that we can work on, a whole lot of my pharmaceutical advertising research is it's from digital images because there are these incredible archives on the web at the New York Academy of Medicine at Duke. There's so much work that I wouldn't be able to do if I had to actually travel to these libraries to see the images, and the images are just there. And there's digital stuff at the library of the Wellcome Institute now, and I used to have to go to London in order to look at stuff, and unfortunately I don't have to go anymore. So there's just a lot changed in both the way we do research and what we do research on.
And this is a good segue. The last question that we'd like to ask you is about advice. So you're talking about your students, you bring them up. What types of advice would you have for aspiring rhetoricians of medicine, science, and technology?
So, advice. I generally tell graduate students that they shouldn't do PhDs unless they really love the work, that they could come out at the end of it and say, well, I'm not going to be able to get a job in the field that I want to be in, but that was an amazing 5 years where I learned stuff that I know I'll be able to use in whatever job that I get. So I require a certain amount of love for the discipline from students, because I don't think that it can only be job oriented. There aren't enough jobs for it to only be job oriented. I think the field itself, if you choose to do science, technology, and medicine studies, I think that that's promising. My graduate students have just sent me, while I was here, their proposals for their final papers. And so the course is Rhetoric of Health and Medicine, and what I asked them to do in their proposals is also tell me what sort of publication venue might be interested in the sort of work that they're doing, which is, I think, important because they need some sense of audience, whether they're planning to publish or not. So if you are writing for the Journal of Medical Humanities, there are certain things that you need to explain and include and exclude and literatures that you have to look at. And if you want to publish in social science and medicine, that's a different set. If you want to publish in RSQ or QJS, that's, again, a whole other set of decisions that you have to make about what you need to supply about methodology and references and all kinds of things. It's obvious. But I have also encouraged them to think pretty widely and to think through all of the different venues that our readings have come from, because they've come from such an extraordinary range of journals, you know, from the Journal of Health Marketing to bioethics journals, like Hastings Center Reports. And, there's so many different ways that you can move the work. So I think advice would include having a very open mind about whom you're writing for and what you think your contribution is. I mean, I think that question of contribution, what do you as a rhetorical critic have to add to a conversation that's going on? I think that's an important dissertation question or MA thesis question to ask. So questions about audience, contribution, kairos, frankly, what is the rhetorical situation and the time and the place into which you are inserting this contribution? So basically, I think that rhetorical questions are good questions for coming up with things that can turn out to be advice.